We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The program is produced by Harriet Williamson, our technical director, Kyle Mabry, this morning. On the program today, Computers in You, Peter Kimball is our guest. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter. Join us with a phone call or by email. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu. Peter, welcome back. Good to see you.
Oh, it's good to be back. Excuse me. It's good to be back, especially after I tried to get here on a defective airplane a month ago.
Yeah, a month ago. We didn't have the show in May. So
they didn't let the passengers vote as to whether they should go. It was only a small leak, they said.
I think I would just be happy sitting on the ground if you got a technical problem or mechanical problem in an airplane. So here it is. It's already June. It's the height of the vacation season, the next few months. And maybe we could talk about traveling with your devices and staying safe on the road.
Well, I think that's something everybody needs to be aware of. You know, the first couple of bits of advice that would be true not only for using public Wi-Fi hotspots like coffee shops and such are really just common sense and more psychological than anything else. And one of those is to guard against becoming complacent. If somebody starts out using hotspots, coffee shop Wi-Fi locations and whatnot, for checking the news headlines and such, and of course there's almost no problem with that. But then they might notice something saying, oh, well, look, looks like this particular stock that I've invested in is going down. Maybe I'll just go ahead and log on to my investment account. Or maybe they'll decide they've been using this almost like their home machine at home where it's much more secure, and they'll decide to go to sites where they are entering logon or password information. And that's where you need to be a little bit careful. Among other things, people who use an ATM, probably nearly everybody, when you're about to enter your PIN number for the ATM, you're kind of aware. You look over your shoulder. You see if anybody's standing there. And if somebody's standing there staring at the screen to see what you enter, you're obviously not going to go ahead. That's a frequent way that logon and other information can be stolen in public places like coffee shops if somebody's just looking over your shoulder, maybe not standing right over you. You'd be aware of that, but it's fairly easy to see, especially while you're just sort of enjoying the day and you're sitting there with your cappuccino or your latte gazing out the window and all this information may be on your screen. So those are a couple of just common sense things that it's so easy to get comfortable and assume that nothing's going to happen to me. That's the other main psychological thing to overcome. Nothing's happened to me so far. You know, I'm safe.
Yeah.
Having said that, there are a number of fairly common sense kinds of things people can do. And if they've listened to this program before, we've on occasion discussed them. Among them, in terms of public Wi-Fi and public spots, when you generally fire up your laptop, you'll see a number of public networks, sometimes half a dozen or more, sitting there. And you want to avoid just choosing the first one or even the one with the strongest signal because you don't know who those hotspots, those wireless access points belong to. Instead, look for a link. A wireless link that has the name of the place you're in, Starbucks or Hilton or whatever it may be. And if there's any doubt, simply ask the staff, what's the ID of your hotspot? There is a attack. It's more common in larger cities and in more congested areas. It's called the evil twin attack. And the evil twin attack is basically somebody who sets up a rogue access point, a wireless router, maybe even with a stronger signal than a coffee shop might have, depending upon the geography and the layout. And people who log into it are actually logging into the malicious potential hackers' Wi-Fi, which will pass on all or nearly all of the legitimate requests, so there'll be no notice to you that things are going on. Strangely, you type in a web address, you click on a link, and you get there. What's happening, however, is all the information is passing through the system of this rogue hotspot operator, and so they are able to see where you're going and what you're doing. That, in turn, can be eliminated, of course, if you are only logging on to the legitimate Wi-Fi site. But even when you're doing that, things are not necessarily 100% secure. I think we spoke a couple of months ago about an add-on publicly available, widely used now, for Firefox browser called FireSheep. Sheep as in they're ready for shearing, you know, lead them to the wolf, etc. And FireSheep allows somebody who is using this plugin to basically hijack somebody's session on Facebook or Twitter or almost any of the social media sites and many others as well. The difficulty being, although it's now getting a little bit better, that most of those sites, when you log on, will have a secure connection. And that's what's indicated by either the little padlock icon on the browser, or if you look closely at the address where it says where you're actually located, like facebook.com, if it starts with an HTTPS, and the S stands for secure, that means it's encrypted and you're fairly safe with that. But many of the sites only have that secure login active during the time that you're actually entering your password. And once you're actually into the site, because it takes a little bit more time and it's a little bit more of a load on their web servers, they move you to just a standard unencrypted HTTP without the S connection.
So should you keep your eye then at the top?
Some sites have an option to say, I would like to continue with an encrypted session, but you in many cases have to opt into it. Be aware the problem is with the FireSheep program, which is just a couple of clicks away for somebody who wants to do this, is once you have logged in and you've logged in securely, the person who is trying to hijack your account won't be able to get that password because that went encrypted and securely. But what those sites will do, such as Facebook, is it'll say, all right, you have successfully logged in. I'm now going to send a little bit of a token back to your machine just for this session, just a number. It's a cookie, basically, is what it's called technically, that will allow you to go to various pages, and you won't have to keep logging in until the next time you actually log out, because it would be a real pain to have to log in every time you move to another set of pages. But unfortunately, if after that cookie has been sent back to you and you've logged in successfully, you're then in an unencrypted, just a standard session, then FireSheep program allows somebody else to actually grab that cookie because it's no longer there encrypted. And the next time you send it out, it's available to anybody who is using another laptop in the area and who has logged onto that same access point. And they can simply use that and do anything that you could do with your account, which is how a number of Facebook and other accounts get hijacked. And there have been, of course, a number of items in the news lately, and who knows exactly what the story is, but the whole Twitter account with the Democratic representative out of New York claims, and quite possibly so, and apparently the forensic evidence tends to support his claim that his account was hijacked, but that's one way it could be done for Twitter or for Facebook or for many of the others, eBay even.
This is Focus, and this morning we're talking about computers with Peter Kimball. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we invite you to join us this morning with your questions and comments about computers. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. or toll-free 800-222-9455. Forgive me, I have a little bit of a frog today. And the email address, you can send questions, comments by email as well, will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the things I'm curious about, and since we don't have anyone waiting for us at the moment on the line, on the phone, or on through email, is I've been thinking about getting a tablet.
Yes.
And I've been thinking, could I use my tablet as a phone? And, of course, using Skype, you could make that work, right?
That's true. You could. It simply needs to have, at the minimum, of course, the microphone. And if you've got video as well, as most tablets do, you can also use the video capabilities of Skype. And that's going to become more and more commonly done.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting that, and there's been a bit of consternation in some circles, but I think it's overblown, that Microsoft is acquiring Skype. But the general consensus is, as Microsoft has done with a few other products they've acquired that are very strong, they have simply let them play to their strengths, maintain their independence, and yet integrated them into a lot of the other things that that Microsoft has some fairly great strengths in, such as a lot of their unified communications capabilities. That is going to be a big issue and a big initiative here at the university over the next year or so.
Mm.
So the answer is yes, you can. There are, with Skype and other programs, always a few concerns. And again, just getting back to our initial discussion of safety, there have been a number of flaws in software programs, including one in early May in Skype, that if exploited would allow a malicious software writer to take control of a computer. In fact, oddly enough, the one that was publicized for Skype in early May only targeted the Mac operating system for people who are using Skype on Macs. And that's going to become the more common vector for trying to compromise a system, not so much attacking the Windows operating system or the Mac operating system, but the applications that almost everybody runs, whether it's Skype or whether it's Facebook or whether it's YouTube or whether it's whatever it may be. So keeping up to date and even for Mac users, who many of whom have gotten away without this for some time,
mm-hmm.
having a good antivirus program to catch that kind of thing, much more likely to catch it, is certainly highly advisable, especially with a lot of the news lately about the Mac Defender Trojan that has been targeting Mac users.
Okay. Let's take a call. This is a listener in Rantoul on line one. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, I joined the program a little late, so I hope you didn't cover this earlier. But I was wondering, if I set up, say, a wireless connection that with no password, so it's open to my neighbors, for example, does that put my computer at risk? Or is that, you know, because I don't care so much if they're using up my broadband in some cases, but I don't want, you know, my files to be compromised.
Well, there are... I can give a three-part answer to that. If you have appropriate software, antivirus software, you maintain the updates, the security patches, whether it's a Mac or a Windows machine, your computer, and you don't have sharing specifically turned on your computer, then your computer is relatively safe. It's obviously a little bit less safe than it would otherwise be. And it's not so much that your neighbor is going to try to take any kind of a snooping approach to it, although it's quite possible that your neighbor's 11-year-old kid might. So that is one issue. And the other aspect of that is it's not just open to your neighbors. It's open to sort of drive-by folks who may be driving by and just parked out in the street. Second factor is, and you just have to take this however you may wish, it does officially violate the terms of your agreement with your internet service provider. And the third is, and this is a little bit more critical, especially in some large areas, you are to some extent responsible for what's being done with that. There have been several cases in the press lately about people who are arrested for the most outrageous cases are for child pornography, in which they have traced a lot of pornographic material being downloaded to the IP address registered to this person. But what it actually is somebody who was nearby and was using your IP address, connecting to it so that it looks like to any of the authorities that anything being sent to or from it is coming from your registered address. My brother-in-law in Florida has a friend who was had a boat on a marina, and the police came and confiscated his computer and such, and he had a computer set up with wireless access, and it was somebody else in the marina who was using that unsecured wireless access point to do all sorts of inappropriate things. So you do want to be careful for that, too.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you. Great show. I'm enjoying it.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling in, and thanks for the compliment as well. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line 2. Good morning.
Good morning. You were talking about people with Macs now needing protection. What can you get to protect your Mac?
There are many different antivirus programs available for the Macintosh. You could find a number of them at the, I think you can find recommendations at the Apple Macintosh site. Certainly they can make recommendations at the Apple stores. And you can go online, do a Google search for Macintosh antivirus, or to avoid perhaps having so many hundreds or thousands of hits, go to a site such as Amazon.com and do a search for software Macintosh antivirus, and then you'll be able to see a number of the reviews. One of the places to also look for reviews are places like CNET, that's letter C-N-E-T, .com, or ZDNet, two computer firms, actually computer publishing firms, that often review that sort of software. But you'll find several different varieties. I believe Norton makes one. McAfee probably makes one. There are several other ones. What you don't want to do, because this is what has been trapping a lot of people, is when you see a pop-up on the screen that says, we think you've got a virus, click here to download Mac Defender. It's not a Defender, although it's named after a program that was legitimate. And a newer one that doesn't even require using passwords that's also malicious is called Mac Guard. So don't ever click on a pop-up message that says you need to have antivirus software, because that's generally the exact opposite. Instead, take the initiative and go to one of the software sites, Amazon.com, or go to one of the review sites, or do a Google search for Macintosh antivirus software review and pick something there. Realize that most all of these, not all, but nearly all of them, will have an annual subscription fee, which you need to be aware of, since the kinds of antivirus attacks is continually changing, and these companies will send out regular updates. Generally, when you purchase a software program, antivirus software program, it comes with typically a 1 or 2 year subscription, which you will then need to renew when that expires at any place between $20 and $30, $40 a year.
Good. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
You're welcome. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Elburn, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. I was just wondering, I got a TouchSmart computer just recently, about maybe 6 months ago. I'm just still learning the thing. Of course, I'm computer inept, but I'm trying to make my own videos and pictures on there so I can try and make, like, my own websites. The problem I keep having is if I want to do a video, it kicks me out. It won't let me go through at all. Is there some kind of device I need to do? Because I'm using a camera on the computer itself. I'm not using a regular video camera. Or do you think I should go separately and get a video camera and set it up different? You know how you got the computer with the picture with the camera on there?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what I've been using straight off of there. It was just a camera.
I'm not. I'm basically familiar with the TouchSmart computers from, I think, Hewlett Packard. But the particular software that you would be using to actually record and then I presume edit, you would also like to do the videos. I'm not familiar with what comes bundled with the TouchSmart. I presume you're using software that came with the TouchSmart to deal with video.
Right.
Or attempting to.
No, attempting to. What happened is I got a virus on there, a couple of viruses, and it doesn't seem like there's a security things out there you can use. It doesn't keep it out. I've got everything on it. I got the Norton antivirus and other things. But long story short, what happened was I had to raise it so high, now it won't let me go in through the camera. So it's telling me that I need to go a roundabout way to go in like your files and create your own files and do all that. When before I was able to just take a picture or a video and then put it on my site, like on Facebook or something. And so it sounds like it might be a better way to do this, but I don't know. I'm trying to figure the thing out. I'm computer inept.
From what you said, are you indicating that the antivirus or the firewall settings are so security conscious that they're not and you believe that's what's not allowing you to do what you were able to do before?
Yeah, and like this morning, I put, because I have my own business website on there, I've been able to transfer photos from my photo album over to my site, my Facebook page, and now it won't let me do that. The picture doesn't show up. You can still transfer it, but like when somebody sends me an email with a picture on it, I can't see it. It won't let me unless, in the small print. And it just, when you go to click on it, and all you get when you go look at the photo, you click on the photo, it comes up dark, and it's got the little white box in the middle and an X on it.
Well, so apparently, and what you have, as you suspect, is a number of programs that are trying to protect you from yourself. A couple of things I can suggest. One, you'd mentioned that you have all sorts of antivirus and protective software. You want to make sure that you are running only one antivirus program. More than one will interfere with each other and can cause various problems. So this is a case where two is definitely not better than one.
Okay.
So if you were running Norton and McAfee or AVS or something, get rid of one of them. It may well be not so much the antivirus part of that software that's causing you problems as it is what's called a firewall. That is a different kind of protective program that prevents certain things from being sent in and out. So you'll want to check. I know Norton comes with a built-in, some versions of Norton come with a built-in firewall. You can check the settings on that. Since you're having difficulty seeing files that are being sent to you, and I presume you're using a browser to try to view those, whether it's Internet Explorer or Firefox, there are additional security settings within Internet Explorer and within Firefox that will, for example, say we're not going to automatically download images unless you specifically click, or we're never going to download images. So it could be that with the security set to the maximum for all of these things, you've basically made yourself very safe, but so safe that you can't get anything accomplished. That's what I would look at. Take a look at the firewall settings, take a look at the antivirus settings. One thing that you can try doing, and just as an experiment, you wouldn't want to leave it this way, is when you're going to try to deal with the video, try disabling the antivirus program. Generally, in the right-hand side, lower right-hand side of the start bar, of the task bar, there will be either an icon showing or an arrow. You can choose to pop up an icon for whatever antivirus or firewall you're using, and you can temporarily disable it. Now, when it's disabled, do not do any web surfing, do not download anything, just see if the video continues to work, and that way you can try to isolate just what it is that's getting in your way.
I will. Thank you. Great show. ILL, I can't thank you enough. I've supported you guys a couple of times, sent you checks, and keep up the good work. I love the shows.
Oh, we appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. This is Focus, and we're talking this morning with Peter Kimball about computers. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Tolono. Hi. Line one, Tolono. Hi.
Oh, hello. Since you like the subscription-based antivirus equipment, what is your opinion of the free antivirus programs that are available for Windows? Thank you. Bye.
Okay.
Well, there are several. I believe that AVS may be one of them, although I don't currently use it, so I would have to look. They are generally going to be quite competent. One of the differences from the better subscription-based antivirus and software protection suites may be the amount of support that you can get directly if you have a problem. Generally, the paid sites are going to have somewhat more robust support, somebody you can actually call and talk to if you need to, or more easily. They may possibly be updated a bit more often or a bit more frequently. My suggestion would be to go to a site such as, well, just go to Google. That would be the easiest thing, and do a Google search for Windows antivirus software reviews. And you'll probably hit some sites, I mentioned these before, such as cnet.com or ZD, as in Ziff Davis, net.com. Unbiased kind of Consumer Reports versions of computer analyses and reviews. And there they will certainly, the last time I saw one of these in a fairly frequent issue, compared the strengths and weaknesses and rated them, much like Consumer Reports does, in terms of their effectiveness, in terms of their cost and such. So the free ones can certainly be quite effective and are infinitely better than none at all.
None at all. Okay, very good. I want to go back to the gentleman from Elburn who called in and ask a follow-up question on his behalf, if you will. Are there textbooks or online courses you can recommend, Peter, for people who are interested in creating web videos and websites?
There actually are several. I don't have a specific bibliography available here, but they range all the way from PC Video for Dummies kinds of books, and I have seen those, you know, the yellow covers. One of the things that the listener or anybody would need to consider is, if they want to just do really quick and easy videos with the built-in software that that comes with the whatever computer system they've got, that can certainly be very simple. It's very cost-effective, but it's going to be somewhat limited in terms of its capabilities. And without going up to the high-end, very expensive video editing suites, since the user is using Windows, one that he might consider is from Adobe called, I believe, Premiere Elements. It's like a junior version of their Premiere Pro professional video editing software. It comes bundled, I believe, with Photoshop Elements, also kind of a light version of Photoshop, at Amazon prices, not much more than $50 or so. And if one were to look at the reviews for that and decide, yes, they'd like to do that, then they should get a specific book about that particular software product. And there are many for that, how to use Premiere Elements. Otherwise, find out from the documentation or just from the help screens within his video application, for example, on that TouchSmart, what company it is or what the actual software product is. Maybe it's just an HP internal thing. Maybe it's something that HP licensed. And then do a search for those books on Amazon, one of the best places to go to look for books, and say, I'd like category books, whatever the video application is.
And what's the learning curve on this stuff?
For most of the consumer-oriented things, it's fairly smooth. If you are comfortable with dealing with files and moving around within computer systems so that you aren't feeling lost with the basic operations of Windows, it's a fairly gentle learning curve. If you're just jumping into it and it's the first time you've really used a computer, it'll obviously be a little bit steeper.
Okay, very good. From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this morning is Peter Kimball, the topic, computers. We'll continue the discussion after a short break.
The new movie Beginners stars Ewan McGregor as a graphic artist whose 75-year-old father, played by Christopher Plummer, has just come out and wants to experience the gay life he denied himself when he was married. The film was written and directed by Mike Mills, based on the story of his father. We'll talk with Mike Mills on the next Fresh Air. Join us
this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
And coming up tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus, dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel will be with us. They join us once a month on the first Friday of the month to answer our questions about caring for dogs, dog behavior, and training. That's tomorrow following the 11 o'clock news on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is Focus. Our technical director, Kyle Mabry. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this morning and talk with us about computers, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have an email address that you can join us at as well. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go back to the phones and take a call from a listener on line one in Champaign County. Hi.
Hi. No cue. Can you go over what you think about the brouhaha about Flash versus HTML5? I see that some of the tablet computers are advertising Flash compatibility. And my understanding of the argument is, and not to reduce it to just Adobe versus Apple, two corporations fighting it out for standards, that if you're looking at battery life and processor use, that the HTML standard is better than Flash. I use a laptop, so I guess I don't really have to worry about it too much, but I prefer not to have Flash, but it is a ubiquitous standard. And so can you go through what you know about the trade-offs and et cetera, et cetera?
Sure.
Thanks.
The as you mentioned, the Flash application, the Flash program or Flash movies are not able to be shown natively on the iPad or any of the devices with the Apple iOS operating system. And the initial reasons that were put forth by Apple was, yes, battery life, as you mentioned. Also, they had found in their analysis that it was the Flash application that fairly frequently crashed and therefore caused the iPad or the other device to crash with it. So Apple decided that they would not support the Flash format on those devices. Problem is that currently the new evolving standard for HTML, called, as you said, HTML5, is not nearly as widely adopted yet and is not as nearly functional as Flash is. Many of the just showing a video sorts of things can be supported in the HTML5 with some of the new tags in there in the video windows. But much of the other Flash functionality that many websites use, such as much of the interaction, being able to fill in forms and do all the rest, is not yet fully implemented. So until websites that have used Flash for more than just kind of the flashy animation screen at the beginning, it's going to take some time for them to move over to the HTML5 format if they indeed decide to do so. So there are a couple of other wrinkles coming into play here. One is, of course, though the battery life is certainly a little bit more limited using Flash, Adobe is well aware of that, and new versions of the Flash Player for tablet-type devices are coming out with some frequency every 6, 8, or 9 months or so, and their battery usage is becoming more acceptable and could be expected to continue along those lines. The other thing is that given the just on the iPhone versus the Android operating system for phones, which in Android is far and away the most popular smartphone operating system now, since there are dozens of companies making them as opposed to just one, Apple has now accepted not native Flash, but websites or applications that convert Flash movies into a more compatible format, sort of a compiled Flash, if you will, now can be shown. So it's not exactly having Flash available, but it is better than the situation was for the iOS, the Apple devices in the past. The final specification, although this is perhaps a little misleading, the final locked-down specification, this is the way HTML5 will be, is not expected to be formally voted on and finalized with all parts in place until about the year 2022. So it is definitely a continuing work in progress with the major emphasis to start with on a lot of the video.
2022.
Well, the request for proposals, request for comments, and yes, the final version is actually about 10 years out.
Wow. Okay.
But it took that long for some of the final aspects of the cascading style sheet specification for the web, and that's not even completed yet. So.
Okay. Well, when I think of all things IT, I think it's going by, you know, everything moves so rapidly.
It does, and there's going to be a lot more happening with HTML5, but it won't be locked into place and unchanging. And that's why I said that was a little bit misleading, because does that mean you have to wait until 2022 to be able to use? Obviously not. There's a lot of HTML5, some of the beginning pieces out there already.
Okay. This is Focus. Our guest this morning, Peter Kimball. We're talking about computers. Let's take another call. This is Bloomington, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
It is. I'm an MLB TV subscriber, and when I watch baseball games on the PC, there's a couple PCs around the house. One of them, the stream comes in just fine, just like I'm watching television. The video is extremely choppy, and I'm curious, is it because of do I need a dedicated video card or just more RAM, or what all kind of things can figure into that? And I'll just hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, I think you almost answered your question. Both of those are going to be significant. There's a lot of processing that has to be done for an incoming video stream, and certainly a standalone, a separate video graphics card, if this is a PC, like a desktop PC that you could plug such a card into, would be much more capable of handling that at high speed than typically built-in graphics that comes with the machine built onto the motherboards. So that's why high-end PCs, and this is true whether you're looking at a Macintosh or a Windows platform, will have a separate graphics card from a company like NVIDIA or ATI or something of that sort. If you have a separate graphics card, the current generation would almost certainly have enough onboard memory, RAM memory, electronic memory on the video card itself to handle all the needs. If you are running the video on a system that does not have a separate graphic system, it's sort of integrated into the motherboard, then certainly much of the memory that's on the system board, the memory that you know that you've got, like 1 gigabyte of RAM or 2 gigabytes or whatnot, has to be shared with that video processor, and that could also make a major difference in performance.
Okay, and I have an email question from a listener. I have a computer type question, but maybe this question would be better suited to someone else, another guest. There are various units available to be able to watch TV via the internet, and I'd like any opinions Mr. Kimball might have. Examples are like Apple TV, the USB dongles that work with some TVs and DVD players, or standalone hard drives that are wireless ready.
Well, I can give a partial response to that. It's not something that I've directly worked with or investigated, and in part because the last couple of people I've assisted with getting network access, video access to their television sets, have both used LCD panels of the latest generation, which actually have software built into them, to be able to stream directly from your internet connection, either wirelessly, so just if you've already got a wireless router, or by running a standard Ethernet cable like you would from a standard router. You plug it into the back, and they can deal with Netflix. They can deal directly with Hulu. The downside is it takes those TVs about 5 seconds or 10 seconds to boot up, because you get the screen now ready for Netflix, now ready for this. There are several other devices certainly available. But I don't have any really good information. That would be a good question for Rich Warren.
Okay. And let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign, line 1. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
I've got myself into a little bit of a pickle because I have a laptop and a desktop, and I have a separate hard drive backup, and I have different files on them, and I want them all synchronized together. Is there, and I would prefer not to do it with by storing files in the cloud. I would prefer to just go from computer to computer. What does your guest recommend for that? I will hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, one of the bits of information that we would need are these Apple or Windows computers.
No, they're all Windows.
Okay. And they are both networked, connected to wirelessly or with a cable?
They're connected wirelessly.
Okay.
But there's no, like, link between the two.
Well, except they're connected wirelessly to your wireless access point or your wireless router, which means there actually is a link between them.
Oh.
And so all you really need to do with this, the precise details depend upon which version of Windows you are running, Windows 7 versus Windows Vista versus Windows XP, etc.
One's a 7 and one's a Vista. The laptop is a Vista.
Well, that still works. They don't have to be the same.
Okay.
In the first thing you would need to do on each of those machines, it may already be done, is to take a look at the network properties. You'll probably have either on your desktop a little icon that shows network, or you'll be able to get it from the start button. And in the properties of the computer itself, there is a place where you can specify what the name of the computer is. So you could call it My Computer, you could call it, you know, Xerxes, you could call it anything you may wish. And there will also be a place where it says, and what is the work group? It'll choose work group or domain. By default, I believe in Windows 7, the name will be work group. I think that may also be the default in Vista, but you need to make sure that the name of the work group is the same for both of those machines.
Okay.
Once that's done, and it may already be that case, then all you need to do is to select what files on your hard drive or what even the entire hard drive that you wish to be able to share. And you can most easily do that by just navigating, start up the standard Windows Explorer, not Internet Explorer, but just Windows Explorer. Double-click on My Computer or double-click on the folder. And then you will see whatever folder contains your information. You can, in Windows, right-click on it, and you'll get a little pop-up menu. And at one point, it will say Properties. And so you click on the Properties menu choice. And then you'll get a window that's got several different tabs at the top. And the one you'll want to look at is the one that says Sharing. And you can specify that any of these drives be shared. You can also look this up, Google, for example, to get some instructions that you can look at in more detail. Sharing files or sharing hard drives, Windows, just do a search along those lines.
Okay.
Basically, what you need to do is on one machine, turn on sharing, or on both of them, depending on which way you want to transfer them or which machine you want to be sitting at when you're transferring.
Okay.
And then on the other machine, you want to do what's called map a network drive. You basically would open up My Computer, and there'll either be a menu option or you could right-click, and there'll be an option to say map network drive. Basically, it's saying, I would like to say that my new drive F or G or H or whatever is actually a drive on this other machine, and then it will be exactly as if they are the one big set of hard drives that both machines can get to.
Wow.
So no separate device necessary. You do have to have the same work group. This set up by default, the name I think is work group on Windows 7. And then you have to enable sharing. And once that's done, all you have to do is tell one machine, I want to map or connect to this other machine. That won't work unless you've turned on sharing on that machine that you're trying to connect to.
So I don't need a special cord to connect them?
That is correct. It will be a little bit. It would be a little bit faster if you had an Ethernet cable that you connected each machine to your wireless router with.
Uh-huh.
But it will work just fine. If you can get to the Internet with both of them, they are already connecting through that router.
Wow, cool. Okay, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
And next we go to a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I have a question. I was one of those people who didn't renew my subscription right away. And unfortunately now I have this virus that he was talking about earlier that's asking to buy the advanced version. of a virus remover. It's a virus, I guess. How do I, can I get this, get rid of this? It's preventing me from doing quite a few things, so I don't know if I can do it myself, but or do I need to take it somewhere.
Are you running on a Windows or a Macintosh?
Windows.
Are you able to surf the web? Are you able to fire up either Firefox or Internet Explorer?
Yeah, I can work online briefly, and then I start getting closing down your hard drive, things popping up, and, you know, it just starts getting crazy.
Yes, well, you're right. You do definitely have a bit of malicious software there. What you do not want to do is click and allow it to do anything it wants to do. It's trying to, you know, bring in its evil twin, so to speak, and do even more damage,
okay.
Or to try to, you know, it's sometimes referred to as scareware. So if you can manage to get online long enough to pick your favorite antivirus location, whether it's Norton or whether it's McAfee or whether it's you know, Viper or any of the others, and if you can manage to get that downloaded, you're in good shape. If you can't, rather than necessarily taking it in the other option, which is not nearly as convenient and might be slightly more expensive, would be to go to one of the computer retailers, could be Best Buy, could be almost any place, and purchase a CD-ROM antivirus product, and that packaging will give you instructions on how to get this in and running on a machine that is already infected with the virus, because it's possible that the software, the infectious software that you've got, the virus or whatnot, may try to prevent you from getting to the legitimate antivirus sites.
Right. Okay, so it's something I have to buy, go and buy. I can't just, like, get it from Amazon?
You can if it's going to allow you to, if you don't have a problem actually getting it downloaded. If you have trouble and it keeps interrupting and you cannot get a successful download from Amazon or elsewhere, then that's no longer an option. And then you can kind of preempt that by actually purchasing the software that comes on a CD, which, of course, the antivirus, which the malicious software cannot prevent you from using.
And I can, I buy something on Amazon.
Sure. Okay. Any number of antivirus. And what you can do if you're looking at Amazon, or even if you can get a Google search, is, as I suggested earlier to one listener, do a search for Windows antivirus software reviews. Pick a site such as CNET or ZDNet, which will be a pretty impartial listing of good and better and best software prices and such. And most of those would also be available on Amazon. And Amazon will give you some reviews, too, user reviews.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I did search the Google and tried to download some sites like that, and my internet just started going to other different sites.
Well, and that's a classic symptom of the malicious software trying to prevent you from doing anything that other than send them money. You'll be able to get to their malicious site just fine, but other sites it would rather you not go to.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Good luck.
Okay.
And next we take a call from a listener in Champaign on line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning. There was a rumor that people who have Skype, their computer might be compromised, as Skype can use that as a node in the system and route their calls through it without you even knowing it. I was wondering, is that possible?
If the system is compromised, and certainly Skype early, and may I mention this earlier, had an issue that allowed Macintosh users who were using Skype to be compromised, but there are other issues certainly possible as well. Once malicious software has been brought into the system, it can pretty much do anything it wishes. So you want to make sure that you are that if there are any updates for the Skype client that you've got, or any antivirus products that are not up to date, make sure they are up to date. With a thoroughly patched, antivirus-protected version, and Skype has already released the improved version of their software that prevents the Mac attacks that were found earlier in May, you should be safe. But in answer to your question, yes, it is possible.
I also was wondering to know that is it possible you have a program running on the background in a computer and it doesn't show up anywhere. Or, for instance, if I start up my computer, my Skype page might pop up, but I do not have anything on my startup menu. I mean, every box is unchecked. But the Skype just pops up. I was wondering, is it something be running in the PC that I'm not aware of and how I can check to see what is running? I look at the task manager, you know, that shows sometimes PC performance as much as 100%, but I got no program running whatsoever at that time.
Well, from that task manager tab, if you click on the processes tab, you will see that there are dozens, if not scores, of processes running. Processes are programs running in the background. That is certainly legitimate because many of the things Windows does do run as processes, but that's where you will see what's going on. If you click on that Processes tab and then down at the bottom where it says See Processes from All Users, if necessary, it'll ask you for your administrative password or an administrator password to see that. Then you can click on the top of the CPU usage column and see which processes, which things are using all of your cycle time, and then once you've got the name of that process, you can type it into a Google search box and see, is this a legitimate Windows process or is this something else going on?
Very well. Thank you very much. Thank you for the information.
Uh-huh. You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. And we've got one last caller here hanging on. I don't know if this is an involved question or not. I think we're going to say we can't take the call today. But we'll be back in July with another show about computers, and it'll be either Peter or Jim and Debbie.
I think it's Jim and Debbie in July, okay. And I'll be back in August.
All right, very good. Well, have a great summer.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Peter Kimball. Our thanks to Peter this morning. He is with the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. And this is a program, this is a topic we take up, Computers and You, once a month on the first Thursday of the month.